Welcome to the Scentcast. My name is Dale Pickles and I am the host of the Scentcast and one of the directors at Bee Squared. The Scentcast is here as a way to help improve knowledge around SEND. Yes, there is lots of stuff you can read, but we're all very busy and we do not have the time. The Scentcast is also a great way to get the same consistent message to schools, external professionals and parents. My guest this week is Joanna Grace. Jo is a sensory engagement inclusion specialist, as well as a doctoral researcher and many, many, many other things. And this episode, we're discussing autism and should or shouldn't we be labelling some autistic people as profoundly autistic. The Scentcast is created and produced by us here at Bee Squared, as well as this podcast and all our assessment products. We also have our Scentcast sessions, which is our online CPD. Jo has previously joined us in the studio to deliver a couple of sessions around autism. If you haven't accessed a Scentcast session, these are video CPD sessions, often with the same great guests as on the podcast. There are over 100 sessions already available, and each year we run 9 live sessions and 2 free send briefings. You can access for free. Great. So we run those every year, and the sessions are £10 per school, and you can watch live on the day, or you can watch later, and you can watch as much as you like. Now, let's get on with the podcast. In this week's show, we're discussing autism and the recent introduction of the term profound autism. Discussing this topic with me is Joanna Grace. Jo is a sensory engagement inclusion specialist, doctoral researcher, author, trainer, TEDx speaker, founder of the Sensory Projects, surfer, and many other things. Joanna has worked with people with learning disabilities and neurodivergent conditions, aged from birth to old age. Welcome back to the show, Jo.
Thanks for the surfer bit.
I love follow you on friends on Facebook, and I have no idea what is going to come up on your feed, and I love it.
Oh, we were just saying before we came on. Yeah, I grew up on a boat, and so the sea is my home. And when I was in my 20s, I used to go surfing as a way of going home. And I'm a dreadful surfer because I grew up on the sea, I have such an enormous respect for the ocean. So I don't look at it as a plaything. I look at it as a very dangerous animal.
Yes.
And recently I've been trying to go surfing again, but I have also been trying to put on the wetsuit that I wore in my 20s. I've ripped the skin off my knuckle doing it, but damn it, I got the thing on.
That's good. And also your wedding dress made an appearance recently as well.
Oh yeah, I had my frock redone. Yeah.
So yeah, and in between all that, there's all the work she's doing. Well, that might be on LinkedIn. There's all the work you're doing, which is also phenomenal. It's a real, I love it, because like, here's all my work. There's me hula hooping. There's me trying to do my PhD. This is how busy my I love it.
It's just me. It is just me online. I haven't got it separated off. And they all feed into each other. So my research at the moment is into embodied identity, and surfing, getting yourself into a wetsuit, is a form of embodied identity. So it's all there. It's all work.
I like my body in a wetsuit. I don't like my body out of a wetsuit.
We've gone off on a tangent really early.
We haven't even near the topic. We haven't started. Right. So let's get back to the topic. So neurodivergence and autism is not a clear description of something. It is simply saying we don't fit into that typical mold. And autism is a huge spectrum connected by a variety of traits, and there's lists all over the place, that autistic people may or may not have. You might have some of them, but also to what degree. So that's my understanding of autism. So what is this profound autism?
I like your description there. When the researchers who've looked at the genetics of autism have identified around 100 genes that are associated with being autistic, and the combination of those genes that you get determines your sort of place on the autistic spectrum. And the effect of those genes on your brain is different patterns in the wiring. And when you look at brains, you can see those patterns. And it's really interesting. When you see the research, they show you brain scans, and they've got 3 different types of ways of imaging the brain. There's a really interesting lecture about this on YouTube by Dr. Caroline Robertson for the CNN network. And she shows you can see the pattern in the brain of a neurotypical brain. It has a pattern to it. And it's not that every neurotypical brain is the same. It's just there is a pattern that's clearly replicated. And when I describe it to people, I say it's like it's tartan. Like you can tell when something's tartan, there's loads and loads of different tartans and every tartan's different. But you can look at tartan and go, that's tartan. And when they look at neurodivergent brains, they can very clearly see that they are not that pattern, not yes. tartan, but they also don't match each other. So it's not like we're all spotty or we're all striped. It's the spectrum is, the word spectrum is there for a very particular reason. It is to indicate the diversity of experience within autism and within the other neurodivergent conditions. And recently, there was a move made by a group of very powerful autism researchers to introduce the term profound autism to denote people who are autistic, have intellectual disability and require seven support, require a lot of support. And that suggestion of introducing that term has been very well received in places, possibly with a little bit of naivety, but a very understandable and hopeful kind of naivety. And then in other places, it's been extremely controversial. And that's what I thought would be interesting to explore today. The reason it's been really well received is because we recognise that the group of people that it denotes are the most vulnerable people on the spectrum. These are the people who don't have access to standard forms of communication, who need constant support in order to be safe, who lead very challenged lives. And the worry that other people have is that in a world where more people are being recognised as neurodivergent, the kind of clamour of voices like mine as an autistic woman, that we might be the people who get heard and those people with exceptional vulnerabilities would be missed. And so the people who are being hopeful in response to this are going, they've got a name. Like, at least if we've got a name for them, they're not being missed. We can spot them. We can, you know, address that. The tricky thing is we had a name for them already. You know, the autistic community refer to people with high support needs and low support needs. And the reason that we talk about support needs rather than the person, because you might have heard before people used to say somebody was high functioning or low functioning. And we chucked those terms out because if you call people like you and I high functioning, it's very flattering, but it kind of takes away from the very real challenges that we experience. And those are not, as I've said on previous podcasts, although I don't need support in my day-to-day life, that doesn't mean that those challenges that I experience aren't very real. And to give dramatic examples, during my pregnancy, being autistic and the communication differences that I experienced threatened the life of my child and my own life. So these are not small things. I just don't need support day to day. They're still very significant challenges. So when you say I'm high functioning, it kind of dismisses the reality of those things. But also, when you call somebody low functioning, it's almost giving you permission to not look for how capable they are. And I know lots of people who would be described or who have been described as low functioning autistics, who I recognise to be very intelligent, very interesting people, and whose parents would say the same thing. You're like, they can't express themselves the way we express themselves. But these terms that describe the person as either functioning or not functioning miss the point. It's the support needs that need the label. And by saying profound autism, you've kind of reintroduced low functioning just under the radar.
See, the thing with that high functioning and low functioning is you've got things like Asperger's is another label which has gone out of fashion. And another one I heard, which is an American term, which is dual and multiple exceptionality. Have you heard that one?
I've heard, multiply exceptional.
Yes, so, and I've heard that, and that's interesting. But what with the high functioning and low functioning, you could either take it as you're talking about their IQ, or you're talking about their ability to socialize. So actually, in a social environment, are they able to function? So in my head, when I hear high functioning and low functioning, what I'm really hearing is high functioning can camouflage themselves, emerge into society, whereas low functioning don't have that ability.
Yeah.
That's how I kind of hear it. But with that high functioning, you're doing it based on how they appear on the outside, not what's going on the inside.
And it makes it sound like it's a fixed thing. Whereas this is another thing that you will learn from a lot of autistic people, is that you can be very high functioning in some situations and very low functioning in other situations. And if you sort of give somebody the label of you are a low functioning person or you're a profoundly autistic person, you're kind of making a presumption that that's who they're always going to be. And you also mentioned IQ there, that people who are advocating for the use of the term profound autism are defining it as people with an IQ under 50. But they're also saying that these are people who don't use language and who... So how are you testing that IQ?
That was going to be my next question.
IQ is a... I mean, IQ itself is a much disputed measure. It just measures your ability to do an IQ test, is what we know. It doesn't have a very strong bearing on your intellectual capacity. And like you think of, I think of a little girl that I know who would fall under this category of profound autism. Her musical talent is extraordinary. You know, she's an exceptional musician. And where is that being recognized if you just call her profoundly autistic? And why do we need these terms when we've got the term intellectual disability, because they're saying these are autistic people who also have an intellectual disability, and autism has no cognitive deficit associated with it. Autism itself is not an intellectual disability. So if what you are looking to support in these people is their intellectual disability, why don't you say that? Why does their intellectual disability need to be called profound autism? And if it's, I lost my other thing then. I've had 3 hours sleep. My children are sick. So we may get gaps like that coming up. Oh, that's it. Why do we need the term? Because as the autistic community, we have this term, high support needs. I can describe this population already. They are autistic people who have very high support needs and a co-occurring intellectual disability. So why do we need another term? Unless you're not willing to listen to the autistic community.
I know the answer.
Oh, yeah?
It's because of Twitter.
Is it?
You've got to describe them in under 140 characters. So if you say, if we have high support needs with blah, 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 it's like profound autism. I've got another 120 something characters I can use then.
Oh, if that was it, that would be really simple. We'll just make an acronym and it'll all be fine.
But that's what I find with so many things, is we simplify things down to get across in a really short, simple way.
Yeah.
And the number of times when we do that, we really give people the wrong... So if I abbreviated something to Joanna about sailing, because we both have sailed, I could say something and you'll know what I meant. Yeah. But if you took it literally and looked it up, it would be completely wrong.
Yeah, okay. So it's because not the place for that ever, is it?
No. So I could infer something, Joanna, and Joanna will go, I'm on that page. Yeah. And someone else would listen to it and not get it. And I sometimes feel that sometimes these terms are said to just get a point across and go, that's an easy way of saying it. But they never think of the flip side of, if we're saying that, what is the negative connotations? What are the negative thing that's doing?
Yeah. And I think there's a really important thing to highlight, which is the listening to autistic people thing. Like, Matt, if you had a child who was deaf and they were struggling with some aspect of that experience, it's perfectly plausible that you would look to find a deaf adult who might have had a similar experience. And that would be the way that you felt you could most understand that child. And there are a lot of autistic advocates now who, when they were children, would have fallen into that category of profoundly autistic, who now as adults are able to articulate that experience and help other people to understand. And I really applaud the parents of autistic children who go looking for the autistic community, because it is a difficult community to engage with at times because it's a very passionate community and we don't always understand how to put things in the most tactful way. But we're always very raw and honest. It, like you were just saying about my social media is always very
raw and honest.
And that's something that you'll commonly find. And we have only recently thrown out the demarcation of different sections of the autistic spectrum, like removing the term Asperger's, which the removal of that was very controversial because you have a group of people who identify as Aspies, who are also people who are not fans of change, who suddenly get told, well, you can't be calling yourselves. So these changes are controversial. But the reason that we remove those demarcations is to recognize that although we are a very dispersed population, there are things we share in common, and the strength of that commonality, like I was saying, if you were trying to support the deaf child, you would ask a deaf adult. But the autistic community is not only not listened to, we are written about in ways that suggest that we're not trustworthy, that we shouldn't be listened to. That I was looking for a particular quote before we came on air this morning because it was really horrific, and I wanted to just check before I said it later on that I had actually read it, because you just wouldn't believe some of the things that people say unless you see them there in print. And I didn't actually manage to find it. So when I say it later, I'll say it very, very carefully. But I did find quotes where they saying things like, if you read an autistic biography, you should, you know, always take it with a pinch of salt. You maybe shouldn't completely trust what autistic people say about their own experience. And that's really weird. You wouldn't have that read about, or don't believe what deaf people say about being deaf, because deaf people don't really know about being deaf. But we will happily say it about autistic people. Don't believe what those autistic adults say, because they don't really understand autism. The people who really understand autism are the researchers who've been studying it and pathologizing it for years.
That kind of makes no sense. It's like saying if you read the book of an extrovert,
yeah. Well,
going, they're an extrovert, so take that into account. And you read an introvert, you wouldn't say that explicit. And all those different personality types, like a narcissist, you wouldn't be going, okay, they're a narcissist, so actually what they're saying happened. It didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
So just by saying that before, that's not good.
You end up in sort of murky territory, don't you? And this is something that when I was writing The Subtle Spectrum and I read an awful lot of autism research to inform the writing of that book. And I was really shocked, as somebody who reads research a lot, I was really shocked by the bias that I encountered within, like, I like research. I like certainty. I like things that can be proved. I want something to base stuff off, and I want research informed practice and all of that stuff. And I think I said on a previous podcast, to give you an example of that bias, there was a really good study conducted that was into quality of life of autistic people 16 to 24. And when I say really good, I mean that it was done by reputable institutions. It was done by multiple people. It was a big team of people. It was an international study. So it was done between England, America, and I think it's the Netherlands. It's published in a high ranking peer reviewed journal. It takes in a huge sample size. You know, this is good quality research. And it showed that age 16 to 24, autistic people are more likely to have been in contact with the police, more likely to have mental health problems, less likely to be in full-time, or more likely to have been bullied, more likely to have been victims of abuse, all of these grim things. And then in the conclusion it wrote, this shows that being autistic causes a poor quality of life. And that is prejudice. You could have done the same research on the experiences of young Black people. You would have found the same things. And you would never have written that being Black causes that. And when we approach research, I think, myself included, you like to approach it as an authoritative thing, as an objective thing. But autism research is fundamentally based on values, because what we're doing at the start is testing a belief about something. It's like if you were testing to find out if something was an apple and you were testing an orange and you tested it and you found out that it's not an apple, and then you described it as, this is a defective apple. This is a lacking in appleness apple. This is a low grade. This is a low functioning apple. This is a profoundly struggling apple. You've made a value judgment on it before you did that test, that there is something wrong with being an orange. That's what's going on in autism research. We're presuming that this is a problem.
And then you put that profoundly bad apple on sale, described as a profoundly bad apple, and it doesn't sell. And the problem is because it's profoundly bad. All the other apples sell, but this profoundly bad apple didn't sell. And that's the problem.
And if you spent all your time trying to make it an apple, you'd end up with, you'd try and smooth off the bumps on its surface, and you'd end up with a really mangled orange. Whereas if you go, ah, this is not an apple, this is an orange. Ah, this will make you like, this will make a great orange juice. This will make a nice marmalade. You're going to start from a much better place. So all of the research starts with values. And I think when you look at the values at the heart of the research of people proposing profound autism, then you would find a set of values that the people who've so embraced the term, who are going, brilliant, you've got a term that describes our children. Our children need your time. Our children need the research. Our children need the money. Our children need the support. You might not find that your values then align, because predominantly those people are looking at the genetics and the prevention and the cure of autism. And wherever you stand on that, whether you think we are a people that should, because obviously autistic people, you know, autism doesn't exist without people. When you're talking about preventing autism, you're talking about preventing people like you and I, in the same way that screening for Down syndrome is preventing people with Down syndrome being born. You could ask a question like, what would society miss if you prevented people like us from being born? Because I think there is a value to these different neurotypes, and you can find any number of great scientists of the past who've been retrospectively diagnosed as autistic. But leaving aside whether you think that this is something that should be prevented or not, if you are somebody who loves somebody now who has very high support needs and needs all that care, you don't care about how to prevent that person. You care about how you can help that person now. That's what we want to find out. How do we make a connection with that person? How do we make that person's life easier? How do we find a way that that person can express their capacities? That's what we want. And that's not what those people are doing who are pitching for this demarcation.
What's interesting is when we think of being autistic, that we think that kind of around the world, wherever we go, we would have the same difficulty. Because it's me, I'm the problem.
Yeah,
I'm autistic, I'm the problem.
Yeah.
But you think about it, in certain places you cope really well.
Yeah.
Certain places you don't. But in just reading, as I've read like about Scandinavia more, I'm literally going, sounds like autistic heaven. Because you read it, they don't do the inane rut chat. they're going to say something. There's nothing to say. I'm not going to talk about the weather.
No.
Who cares about the weather? It's his or it isn't. And you read it going, I like this. This makes sense to me. So I sort of wonder that if you are autistic in Scandinavia, will you have less problems with the rest of society?
Yeah.
Because those expectations on you are different compared to life in the UK, where we're very social, we'll talk about the weather and how different PG tips is to Tetley and all some random rubbish, which doesn't mean anything. And the fact that you can't do it, you're not that fussed about which is your favourite person in One Direction or whoever's the latest, you don't really care because it's not a great song. That's the sort of thing I sit there and there are cultural differences where I think we fit in more or we don't. And there's, to me, when we talk about the thing, so like going back to the bit about the reason all these people are getting into trouble is because they're autistic. No, they just need, actually, in the same way we just need to have clearer understanding, clearer communication, not be biased. It's things like that. It's just.
So this is like a nice little example, because one of the fears is that people like you and I, in talking about our autistic experience, and like I've lived in Germany for a couple of years, and I was less autistic in Germany because people were more direct in their communication. But in talking about those experiences, we kind of take up the bandwidth and we use up the attention and the resources and the stuff that's available in the general world for attention on autism. But actually, in what you've just said, in that what you're saying is that in a different environment, I experience this neurotype as less stressful, or I meet more challenges. That's an example of something that we have in common across the spectrum. If I was looking to support somebody so my work generally focuses on people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities, people in the UK who are referred to as having profound and multiple learning disabilities, who may or may not be autistic as well. And there you go, 3 hours sleep.
Got it again.
Who knows? Wonder what the other end of that sentence was. Let's go back round.
Different environments.
Different environments.
You were saying I'm less autistic in Germany. Then we went to different environments. Then you went to...
You just saw it evaporate, didn't you? I think, and if this wasn't what I was going to say, I'll come back and find it later. Don't worry. It'll be on the bedroom floor somewhere. But when I first started talking about being autistic, oh, that's it. I found it. I was close. So I work with those people who have very high medical care needs and things like that. And I have often been asked, and this is a really shocking question, and it's shocking how casually it gets asked as well, whether I think those people should be alive. Because I understand why people ask it. They look at somebody in a funky wheelchair who's having a lot of medical support, and they look at that life and they think, I wouldn't want to live that life. Like, why are we keeping that person alive? Like, people say things like, if that was an animal, you would have it put down. As somebody who's familiar with that population and who often knows the person that they're talking about, you're like, what the? No, this is so-and-so. She's having a great time. Yeah, her body works differently to yours. And yes, she has to go through an awful lot of stuff, but she loves this stuff. And if you play her this song, she's having a ball. She's really embracing the life that she experiences. And if I'm really brutally honest, the times in my career when I've looked at somebody and wondered whether theirs was a life worth living, it's not been with regards to people with profound intellectual and multiple disabilities. It's been people who would be caught up in this term profoundly autistic. It's been people who've been so stressed by the environments that they're in. They're living in a state of constant distress. And you look at that life and you think that just looks cruel. It just looks like if that was my life, I would be jumping off something, and you're not able to jump off something because we're holding on to you. And all those are the times when I really, really recognize how profound that need is and how important the recognition of that population is. But I think where you get that support is from Neurokin, is from other autistic people. Let's have autistic researchers. And actually, if you look at the autistic researchers who are managing to come through in the research community, you have people like Damien Milton doing the double empathy work, and you've got a way better insight into how you support somebody than you do from a study that once again tells you that you're not an apple. they're even more not an apple this time. Or we found out which bit's causing them to not be an apple. You're like, great, it's all really interesting science stuff. But it doesn't help those people. And I think what the autistic community have in common with the sort of the care community, the parents and the carers of people who have very high support needs, is that we all want to see them done right by. And I know some amazing autistic people who spend their lives working to help people with higher support needs, and they should be listened to in the same way that you would listen to the deaf adult to support the deaf child.
But it's just, you said the bias is just there, so I'm still stuck on that research where the reason they've had such a hard life is because they're autistic. It's like,
yeah,
so basically you started with the bias that the problem is autism.
Yeah, you shouldn't be autistic. Let's see how we go from there. the people who are pitching for Profound Autism are people who are looking to prevent it. They're also people who are heavily involved in like behavior approaches to fixing it.
But I would love to.
More responsive approaches work better. They're more humane. They're kinder. They're more respectful of a person.
I would love to be able to get like a COVID style test. Yeah. Where it kind of tells you if you're autistic or not. Yeah. I'd love that. And then we did it and we actually realized that it's not like 1 in 100. It's actually 1 in 10. Yeah. Or even that. And it's actually, it's like, hang on. Everyone who's okay. Interesting. It's like, and I think you probably find that some of these researchers who have this bias against autism are the ones who actually are autistic. But they've masked so well. And they go, well, we all have these problems. That's the other thing. You get parent going, but we all struggle with this. We all struggle with this. Like, no. Not everyone does.
So I give an example when I'm talking about, because the spectrum sometimes gets understood as that some people are very autistic, some people are sort of quite autistic, some people are a little bit autistic. And then you continue on to people who are not autistic but are a little bit sort of autistic, and then to all the way down to people who are profoundly not autistic, you know, severely not autistic, the ones that have to have a boyfriend lined up before they dump their current boyfriend and have to be talking to their friends on the phone all the time, otherwise they don't know they're alive, like those severely neurotypical ones. And you get that idea of a linear spectrum and a continuous spectrum between people who are and are not autistic. And so when you say it's a binary condition, you're either autistic or you're not, it doesn't seem to match up with that description of a spectrum. But if you could relate it to a different binary condition, like being pregnant, you can recognize that you are either pregnant or you are not pregnant. And then within being pregnant and within not being pregnant, there is a range of experience, and a lot of that experience will overlap. Like if you imagine a pregnant lady talking to a not pregnant friend and going, I had to get up 3 times in the night for a wee. People have said I've got to get sleep before the baby's out, but I can't get sleep because I'm up all night weeing. And then her mate says, oh, yeah, I have to get up a lot to wee in the night too. It's really naff, isn't it? When that's nice. That's understanding. The pregnant lady goes, I've got a really bad back because the baby's sitting low on my spine. And the friend goes, yeah, I lifted a box at the weekend and twinged on my back. And it's not nice to have a bad back, is it? We've got this in common as well. That's nice. That's understanding. I don't fit into my jeans anymore. Yeah, I put on 1/2 stone at Christmas. I don't fit into my jeans anymore. It's fine. It's nice. At the minute at which the not pregnant lady goes, I guess we're all a little bit pregnant, it stops being a nice conversation and the pregnant lady wants to hit her. Like, no, I'm pregnant. You're not. There's a lot of overlap. And that overlap is really nice for empathy and for understanding, but it's not the same thing.
There is a really little good cartoon by a lady called Rebecca Burgess, which I will find and I will stick in the show notes, which does it as a colour wheel. And it really talks about it in different situations. So in this situation, I'm not that autistic, but here, because my communication is great, but here, as soon as it gets noisy, and it is really, to me, that is the best way of explaining it. And I'll find the link because it is a brilliant little cartoon which does it as a colour wheel. And we're all at different places on this colour wheel, which is, yes, it's called a spectrum.
Yeah. So I am being interviewed on a podcast. I am an articulate person, but I experience times in life when I lose access to language. And I wonder if that's hard. I'm actually just thinking to myself about what we said about my social media. Maybe I should tell my husband, like, next time I lose it, film me. Because it's a very weird experience for him, because he talks to me. And it's like our times have gone at different speeds, because I register that he's spoken to me. And I'm pretty sure that I'm speaking. And I'm not sure I'm speaking back. I'm sort of about to speak back, but I never kind of get round to the it's like being an old-fashioned video on pause. And so he's there watching it probably very lightly, because you remember when you pause the old videos, the screen would sort of jitter a bit. It's like that. He's looking at me and I'm just like making this weird movement, and sort of I'm moving towards him with language, but no language comes out. And my mum remembers me doing it when I was younger, and she said, honestly, Joe, I used to think sometimes that if I just like hit you on the back, maybe the words would come out, because it looked like. And so in one situation, when you listen to me on the radio, you go, she's not that sort of autistic. She's the other sort of autistic. And that's what they want. What they want is for people like me to be silenced in relation to people like that. And when I started to speak about being autistic publicly, which is something that I didn't used to do in relation to my work, because I worried that it would discredit me in some way, and it does, because autistic people are not to be believed, or we're saying these things just because we're autistic. I was really worried that my speaking would detract from people who lead more challenged lives. But what I've found is that it is the parents of people who lead more challenged lives that I hear from on Messenger and like direct message on Twitter, because I'll say something about my experience. Like, I have it in my contract when I work that I work without my shoes on. So I quite often explain to people why I'm working without my shoes on. Now, I can wear shoes. It's fine. Just in the same way as you could lie in a coffin, you'd be fine because you know you're not dead and you don't have to stay in it. And if I asked you to lie in a coffin and I maybe put the lid on, you would lie there and be like, yeah, this is fine. It's fine. I know I can move in a minute. I can't move right now, but that's fine because I'm going to be out of this in a minute. It's fine. I can do this. I'm not dead. They're going to take the lid off in a minute. And you would be fine, but your concentration would be taken up by being fine. And if I put shoes on, I can really feel that I've got my shoes on and that my feet are trapped. And so I'm like, it's fine. It's just shoes. And a little part of my head is just dealing with the, don't panic. It's just shoes. It's okay. It's just shoes. Don't worry. It's just shoes. And that's like takes up 10% of my bandwidth, just going, it's all right. It's shoes. It's shoes. It's just shoes. Don't worry. I buy my shoes half size too big so I can still wiggle my toes in them. So it's like a bigger coffin. Like, and it's fine. It's fine. And I can manage it. But also, as somebody who can articulate that, I can explain what's happening. As somebody with the power that I hold as a person who gets paid to talk about stuff, I can mandate in my contract that I will not be forced to wear my shoes. And that means I'm able to take my shoes off when I'm talking to audiences and just give them my full concentration. It means I can give them all of my concentration. I don't waste 10% going, it's just shoes, don't panic, it's just shoes. And when I say stuff like that, I quite often have parents come up and say, my little boy doesn't like wearing his shoes and I make him wear them. And then they kind of look at you like, am I a bad mum? And I say to them, like, I understand. Like, I make my children wear shoes too. There's a reason that people wear shoes. There's a reason I wear shoes. But then their next thing is like, he could probably have them off more. I like, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Because if he's feeling what you're feeling, I think he might be feeling what you're feeling, but more of it. And that's it. The adult autistic community, or the autistic community who can articulate these things, we feel a responsibility to articulate them for those people who can't, because we're neurokin. They're part. Like, I really feel a very strong connection to other autistic people. And I think it's really dangerous that our voices be silenced. And it's weird. There's a really brilliant lecture by Monica Botha, who is an autistic researcher who researches autism. And she talks about how autistic people are silenced in research. And she said she used to talk about these things before she was a researcher, and she was told, you don't understand the research, you're not allowed to say this stuff. So she became a researcher, and then she was told, well, you're autistic, so you can't understand this research about autism. And she's like, I do. I've studied, I've read it all the same as you. Why are you saying I don't understand? And then she says in the lecture, like, I've got this qualification. I've had this many peer reviewed journals. I've got my doctorate. I am this qualified as a researcher. And people will still, to her face, say, you are not entitled to speak about autism because you're autistic. You are not allowed to know about autism because you're autistic. The only people that have authority to speak about autism are non-autistic researchers. And the quote that I was trying to find before we came on air was one that it was so shocking when I read it that, like, it's imprinted in my mind. I will remember it forever. So I know I read it somewhere, but it's not to do with the work that I'm doing. So it hasn't found its way. And I have a system of taking notes for the research that I'm doing. And it's not, I'm not doing research about autism. I couldn't do research about autism. The rhetorical violence that autistic people who work within that field are exposed to on a daily is not something I could survive. I wouldn't manage it. I found it hard enough reading it all just to write The Subtle Spectrum. But it was by, oh, I mustn't say who it's by, because unless I can point to it on paper, it was by a very famous autism researcher on record as saying, the trouble is, if we let autistic people become researchers, they'll take jobs away from non-autistic researchers who've got decades of experience of doing this. It's like, we've been doing it wrong for a really long time, and we really object to you lot coming along with your deeper insight into this and suggesting that it might be okay to be an orange. It's not okay to be an orange. You must all be apples.
Okay, so first of all, yeah. I buy my shoe size is half a size too big.
Yeah, that's the right thing to do.
Because I like wiggling my toes. Yeah. If I can't, I do. And I'm literally going,
can't
okay.
Leave. No, you're quite
right. Another thing about me I didn't realise was the autistic part. But I generally, whenever you meet me, unless I'm at a show or I'm at a school, I'm in jeans and T-shirt because I can ignore my clothes.
Yeah.
As soon as I have to put on a shirt and trousers, I have to worry about how I'm looking. And it does take up a bit of that concentration. And if you're going, you just stick it on and forget about it.
I remember seeing you in a shirt. I think I saw you at a shirt at the Tez.
Yeah, I will put on shirts. But I will get out of it. Even when, if you see me in the studio filming, so when you
come, like a dog with socks on.
Thanks. I wear the shirt when I'm on camera and I take it off again.
Yeah. Okay.
Just because, but partly I do that because if I only wear it for 1 hour a day, it lasts much longer till I have to wash it again, which just makes more sense. Mm. But I think that, yeah, being comfortable and things like that is really actually important. There are things which occupy your mind which are much bigger, but. Oh, right. So profound autism. Yeah. I think it's attractive because I reckon if you hear that your child is profoundly autistic, you're going to get a lot more support. But then I worry about it would have to have a very clear definition. And then if your child's got an IQ of, let's say, I think you said the barrier is 50. If your IQ of 55, now you've got a line, which is I'm not sure I even think about.
Oh, it makes it very weird, doesn't it? Like, what if they get a bit better and then you don't qualify for the support? Shouldn't the support just be given based on need? They've got high support needs. Let's answer those high support needs.
Is with the IQ test, are they able to answer in a way that works for them in a time frame?
You can't do an IQ test on somebody with an IQ of lower than 50.
One of my first podcasts with you, Joe, you said... See, the thing with me is someone will say something and I'll give a very kind of the response I'm supposed to give, but it's kind of, I think it's like a kaplunking through your head and it takes 10 minutes to get there and then I'll respond. And during that podcast, I said something.
Oh, yeah.
You gave me a very polite response. And then 10 minutes later, you came back with the best response. And I was like, wow, literally, I could have done it. I could have started a stopwatch 10 minutes type thing to the T.
Yeah.
And I sort of going, so... It's not maybe intelligence, it's process. It's just, there's so many things that you are, again, with the IQ test, it's like, if you've got a bird in the bush and a bush in the hand, I'm going, what? Someone else is probably going to say that saying perfectly. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush or something is a phrase, which makes no sense to me. But I remember seeing that on an IQ test, just going, I'm not old.
I think. There's no disagreement that that group of people are especially vulnerable, that group of people need identifying, that they deserve the support first, they should be the priority for funding, all of that. We all agree on that. Where I disagree is that we need the term profound autism to do that. We already have terms that do that. We already have systems that can do that. I think the term profound autism is a power play move from a group of researchers whose research is based on a particular value base. And I don't think that value base best supports those people denoted by that term. In fact, I would argue it harms.
Because to me, when I thought profound autism, in my head, I was thinking... There are autistic people who are intelligent, are amazing, blah, 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 in their own house.
Yeah.
But when they leave their house,
yeah,
they're not able to blend in. I will use that term.
Yeah.
They can't follow the social norms out in public, but you stick them in their own home, you communicate with them online, they are amazing. So, and he's like going,
you meet a
so
lot to me, that autistic kids who are just struggling because they're at school. And like, I support schools, and I remember a lovely meeting where it was the parent, the teacher, the Senko, the head teacher. They were all desperately wanting to support this child, and the school were willing to do anything. They were going to bend over backwards, they would provide it. And at the end of the day, what the girl was struggling with was being asked to be in a social environment with that many other people. And I was saying to the school, unless you're prepared to like get rid of most of the rest of the class, for all your good intentions, this is what she's struggling with. And a lot of autistic young people have to deal with all of that first before they can begin doing their education and learning the other things. And I think we struggle with an idea that, you know, you have to learn this bit of maths at this age. I think there's like a different curriculum going on for some autistic people, in that it's useful to us to learn a bunch of other stuff first, and then we can get around to learning the maths. And you can learn the maths at a different age. It'll be all right.
And the maths is you have to be able to do chunking, then this, then this, then this. And I remember my daughter just got maths this way. And I was like, cool, do it that way. She went, no, I keep getting told I'm doing it wrong. It's like, but you're getting the right answer. Yeah, but I've got to learn it in this order, and I'm doing it the wrong way. Apparently I'm doing the year six way in year two, and it's wrong. But to me, someone that is almost profound autism to me, because it is that autism preventing them from accessing society and being part of the world. But that's not their fault or their problem, because if they're fine at home, it's society's problem. So we shouldn't be saying profoundly autistic. We should be praying profoundly society against them.
It's an odd one, because we do want to describe people, and we do want to highlight them. And that is, it's a very convenient term. It makes sense, you know, immediately off the bat. It's just that awareness that when you use it, you're kind of placing a vote as to like whose side you're on, because there's a bit of sides going on here. And if you look at the term was introduced in The Lancet by a huge group of researchers in 2022, and they proposed that we use this term. If you look at the response to that, you've got big autism groups going, yes, great. But then you have loads of self-advocacy groups or autistic-led groups going, no, hang on, no, no, stop, why? And there are two sides. And if you use the term, you're picking sides, just as if you don't use the term, you're picking sides. And loads of people will just be using the term without realizing that there's sides. And so I guess that's what we're doing on this podcast, is going, by the way, you're choosing sides. And I just think there's such a logic to listening to autistic people if you want to understand autistic experience. And if you want it to be validated through the research process, listen to autistic researchers. That person who was saying, you know, the trouble is they come along and take our jobs. Imagine if there was a long history in this country of studying Black history, and it was all the people who had studied Black history were white people. And then suddenly a Black person wants to join the institution and study Black history. And they go, no, you can't. We have been studying this for ages. This is not for you. You shouldn't be a part of this. You're not quite. And they're going, hang on a minute, I think I might have a better insight into this, because like my granny is also like a part of this history and stuff. That's what's going on here. Autistic voices are being silenced. Autistic researchers are being sidelined. They're being told that we cannot have epistemic authority, is the term for it, that we're not allowed to know about autism. We can't be an authority on autism because we are autistic. And it's that because we are autistic that is presuming the problem before you've done any research. It's a values-based thing, and they've decided that we are wrong, and then they move from there. And their aim is to stop us from existing, which is a huge debate. And it's not, you might listen to me and think, well, you're autistic, so of course you're going to want autistic people to exist. I'm not so certain. You know, I remember those people who were so distressed. I know my own distress. You know, I don't know where I would fall on that. I hope, you know, in general, I don't want people to be screened out. I don't want there to be screening out for Down syndrome. I like the diversity. But it's not just a clear-cut thing that because I'm autistic, I think that there should be autistic people. I just think that if you're looking to support somebody who's really struggling, you don't find that support in something that would have prevented their existence. You want to find some support for them now. And where you find support from them now is from people who understand them now. And I mentioned Damien Milton. His research is a perfect example, isn't it? He did the research that challenged the theory of mind stuff. So there's an old trope about autism, which is that autistic people don't have theory of mind, which means that we cannot think ourselves into other people's shoes. Loads and loads of people still believe that that's true of autistic people, even though Damien Milton's work has demonstrated clearly that it's not. We do have theory of mind, just like everybody else has theory of mind. And just like everybody else, we have theory of mind for our own neurotype. So when they looked at how well non-autistic people understand other non-autistic people, they understood them quite well. When they looked at how non-autistic people understand autistic people, they didn't do so well. They looked at how autistic people understand other autistic people. They understood them really well. They looked at how autistic people understand non-autistic people. And funnily, they actually did better at understanding the non-autistic people than the non-autistic people had done at understanding the autistic people. And it's, so you could go, so autistic people have got more theory of mind, which is not the case. We all have equivalent theory of mind. Autistic people have just had more practice at trying to understand what neurotypical people are doing. But when you see that work, it's there as research, as like good, hard, demonstrated stuff. What you learn from it is if you want to understand what's going on for an autistic person, the person who's most likely to be able to put themselves in their shoes, a size too big, is another autistic person. And so you would look to the autistic population of researchers. And then if you look at the profound autism thing, it is partly a move to silence that population.
Just hearing the term profound autism, I personally took as their autism is preventing them from accessing the world.
Yeah.
What you're saying is profound autism is not even about autism. It's saying they have an intellectual disability and autism.
So it's a tricky one, isn't it? So I agree with denoting the group. The terms, we were already, the autistic community were already denoting that group by saying they have very high support needs and they have an intellectual disability. The move to introduce this term, which came just last year, has got a lot more politics around it than just the attempt to denote that group. And yeah.
Because you're saying that this person here, who is an intellectual, the reason they have such an intellectual disability is because they are profoundly autistic. So therefore, you're saying the autism is...
Yeah, it's a weird one that...
That's what I'm hearing. It's like, actually... The autism is actually the disability is their autism. It's like, no, there's something else.
There's a weird muddling there. Yeah. When they said we should define this group of people on the spectrum as profound autistic because these are the people who need the time of research. These are the people who need the funding. These are the people. And we agree with all of that stuff. Yes. Those are the people who need focusing on. People like you and me, Dale, we are not top of the list and nor should we be. But they then really struggled to say who that group was. Like when on the first pitch, everybody goes, yeah, I get it. It's those people. But how do you decide who those people are? Because this is another problem with functioning labels. The people themselves don't stay in place, do they? It's like you were saying, like at home is amazing. Out in public, great. Joe on the radio can talk nonstop. Joe can't catch taxis because I'm not able to have the conversation. I mean, you're laughing. I'm not able to have the conversation with the taxi driver because it's a part of social communication I haven't learned yet. So I regularly walk long distances across cities late at night on my own. And then you look at the rates of sexual attacks on women like myself. They are higher. There's a reason they're higher. And that's one of the reasons, isn't it? I'm putting myself at risk more often because in that situation, I don't have the social communication skills that I have in this situation. So you can't actually, it's like trying to pen a group of sheep. We're like, those ones are the profound, oh no, hang on a minute, that one's got out because that's not profoundly autistic anymore. It's these ones, these are the, oh no, but she's really good at music, so she's not really profound. And these are definitely, it doesn't stay put. So when you put the description as being in the person, it doesn't say put, which is why the autistic community label the needs. This is a person who has high support needs. Yes, that's fine. This is a person who has high support needs when she catches taxis. Yes, low support needs if you wanted to talk for ages.
Uber makes life easier. I love Uber. So I remember, you get in a mini taxi and it's like, where are you going? And then they start chatting to you and like, you're going here, like, where's that? And you have to half. But when you get an Uber, it's on the map, it's paid for, it's done. I'm not saying, but to me, I know what you mean. There's that, what am I supposed to say? Do I literally say, been working long, been busy?
I don't know if you're supposed to, and people say, it doesn't matter, they don't mind, but it's not true because the social communication always matters. And this is what you learn as an autistic person because you got it wrong so many times. When they go, nobody minds, that's a trick. They're lying to you because they definitely minded before. All the little chit-chat does matter and you have to get it right.
In Uber, sometimes they just don't talk. It really is. Because sometimes, especially when there's a group of you, they just learn. They don't talk and you give me everything. I don't need anything from you. So Ubers are a different rule. And I like Uber for that reason, that I don't feel pressured into talking. I don't have to go, he's going the wrong way. Because I can see on the sat-nav that he's following the sat-nav. It's taking him to exactly where I want. It's quite autistic friendly, these Ubers, but they're not everywhere.
It's not rural friendly. Yeah, I was somewhere the other week and I did an hour and a half walk because there were no taxis, even if I had known how to have that conversation.
Wow. So let's wrap up, Jo.
Yeah. People with high support needs and intellectual disability who are autistic deserve to be top of the list for funding, for attention, for understanding, for all of it. There are terms that denote them. And the use of the term profound autism is maybe a more political move than simply an attempt to denote them. If you want to support those people, my recommendation would be to seek out the autistic community, to seek out autistic researchers, and to understand them from their neurokin. Just as if you were looking to understand the deaf experience, you would ask a deaf person. There's a sense to it.
One of the interesting bits, which I almost brought up earlier, was on a podcast we recorded not long ago, I swapped seats with Fintan.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
So Fintan was the host, I was the guest. And to me, we just did a chat, but we sat in different chairs and it was perfectly normal to me.
He said it was really...
And the end of it, Fintan said, it's horrible, horrible. And I'm going, why? We just had a conversation. But I had to think about what to do next. I had to think about this. It was really stressful. And I'm going, but that's what I do in every single conversation in my life. And that realization that he just has a conversation. He just says what's in his head and off he goes.
Weird.
Whereas I'm balancing the conversation in my head. I'm thinking about the next thing. I'm trying to do connective things. I don't know if Joe says this. I don't want to kind of plus 10 her and outrank her with my experience. I want to give it an equal experience. And I get really worried about all those sorts of things. And I'm going, no. Then I'm sort of going, I have no idea. I've got to let Joe talk. And I have all these stuff going on in my head in every conversation, whether I'm on podcasting or I'm talking to you at a show or I'm talking to you at lunch.
I rehearse small talk out loud in my car as I drive, like somebody practicing lines for a play. Whenever I'm in the car on my own, I practice my small talk lines out loud. I know everybody plans what they say. It's like that conversation across the pregnancy divide. Everybody plans what they say to an extent. You think before you speak. But the level to which I'm doing that is the level to which an average person would be practicing lines for a play. I've got to say it out loud. And then I have to hear it to see if I've got the intonation right. Because that's one of the things we often like, if you say it flat, if you don't say it with the right. So I'll say it multiple times to see if I can hear if I'm getting it. And then that's that weird thing of trying to listen to yourself whilst you're talking. But yeah, if you drive past me and I'm in the car on my own, I look like I'm chattering away to somebody and I'm practicing my small talk. It's not very good yet either. So if you meet me for small talk, it's not going to be good.
But it's really fascinating when we do this. But it's most of the time when we judge an autistic person, we are doing it based on what we are seeing on the surface. We have no idea what their toes are doing or anything like that. We are literally judging what we see, what is not going on inside. And that inside part, that's the bit that they don't even realize that what's going on for them is different at a young age. And as you grow up and you realize, and someone says, I buy shoes half a size too big, and you're going, oh. And someone else says this, that's how ADHD people write essays. I'm going, oh, 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 oh my gosh, you learn so much that if someone told me that no one else did this and that, it would have made my life so much easier.
Yeah.
But so, yes, I am autistic. Yes, I have ADHD. 99.9% of the time, I do not need any support. And even that 0.1, I probably don't need support. It's just hard. And I just need to take me longer. And then there are people who are autistic who need a lot of support, and they need that support. And hopefully when, okay, correct term, I say the term, I'm less impacted by my autism. I don't know the correct term because Asperger's, I don't know. Yes, I'm in the community, but I do feel like I don't belong because I'm only just in, is how it feels. Yes, I'm just off the colour. I'm a slight grey. It's that sort of thing. I don't feel that autistic. And even everything I'm saying is completely wrong, and I get that. But I feel like I haven't earned the badge because it's not impacting my life that much. But then as I've gone through this year, I've realised it has impacted me hugely. It's been very internal. So it's really complicated. But the good thing is, anyone sharing their experiences as an autistic person is shining the light on everyone, to me.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's how it feels. I don't want those of us who have lower support needs detracting from the people who need the support. But I don't think that's what any of us are trying to do. I think you're trying to articulate the experience in order that people understand across the neuro divide, and you hope that some of that understanding touches the people who need it most.
Yes, it's just if we can help people understand that actually it's just different and things are going inside, and people just take a bit more cut and just a bit more understanding and less bias when they're talking to anyone autistic, we're winning.
With the autism research.
Excellent. Right. Thank you for coming to the show today, Jo. Really enjoyed it. I've now learned what profound autism is, and it's not even what I thought. So that's a whole thing. I'm never going to use that term, and try and pick up those who too try to use it. As always, I've got Joanna's contact details, so you can find her on various places and see what she shares. It's always interesting, and I love it. And don't forget to follow us on social media, on Twitter or the artist formerly known as Print or X, whatever we're calling it this week, at The Sendcast, on Facebook, The Sendcast, on Instagram, The Sendcast. And if you listen through Apple iTunes, Apple Podcasts or Amazon, anywhere you could leave a review, please leave a review to let others know what you think. And before we go, I would just like to remind you to check out Sendcast Sessions. This is from us, the same people who do The Sendcast, but it is online video CPD. Jo has joined us previously. She's done a session which has been brilliant around autism neurotypal behaviour. And you can join a number of our sessions throughout the year live and be part of the Q&A, or you can watch later. So although Jo's session's already happened, you can go along, find that session, pay £10, and that is your session forever. We also run free send briefings twice a year to keep up to date with what is going on in the world of SEND. So have a look on the Sendcast website, and you'll find loads and loads and loads of video CPD. Really, really good. So thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Sendcast. It is goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
Bye, everyone.